Hi there, and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years, and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them, and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast series, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds, and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experiences. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share, and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. And without further ado, let's get to today's episode. Well, I don't mind saying that if I had half the CV of the man sitting in front of me today, I would be more than happy. After studying, Gary McGann got a job with the Controller and Auditor General and spent 7 years in the civil service before joining mobile technology company Ericsson in 1978. He spent nearly 11 years there, eventually becoming the company's chief financial officer. He then took up a role with drinks company Gilby's in 1988 and became its CEO in 1991. In 1994, the Irish government appointed him as chief executive of Aer Lingus, a position he held until 1998. The job was to overhaul the company, and he succeeded in keeping it afloat with several restructuring measures. Then, in 1998, he joined Jefferson Smurfit as chief financial officer and eventually became its CEO in 2002, leading a successful merger with Dutch company Kappa to create a truly global business of Smurfit Kappa that we know today. He finished there in 2015. He has also held several chairman positions in his career in companies such as Dublin Airport Authority, Aritzia, Sycon or Sisk, the construction company, Aon Ireland, and most recently Flutter Entertainment, and board seats at UDG and Green REIT. He's a former president of IBEC, and in the not-for-profit sector, Gary's a director of Barnardo's and the Ireland Funds. Now, I hope I got everything right there, Gary, or Nikki will be on to me, but you're very, very welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Aidan. It's all good.
That's glad to hear that. Now, if we go back to, I suppose, let's take the easy question to start with. If you go back to your Controller and Auditor General days, was it always the plan to have the type of career that you ended up having?
No, not at all. My mother was a nurse. She was a theatre sister, I think, in the Richmond at the time, which is long since gone. And I did well in science, and my mother and father were both west of Ireland. And it's, I think, a typical Irish thing anyway, but certainly the west of Ireland parents, their real legacy and the only legacy they really believed they could give you was education. And so I went to an all-Irish school and did well, obviously in Irish, but I did well in the sciences, and my mother decided you couldn't waste that, so I should do pre-med. There was only one snag with that, and that was I had no aptitude for it, number one. Number two, the sight of blood, particularly my own blood, but anybody's blood, scared the living daylights out of me. So I spent a couple of months in pre-med until somebody, the professor of zoology at the time, she was about 70 years of age, renowned woman, about 4'11" and a tyrant, and basically handed me a rabbit and a scalpel and asked me to cut it, and or dissect it, I think she described it at the time, and I said I couldn't possibly do that. She said, well, you need to do it or to leave, and so I left. But I'd been beaten into doing the civil service exams as a fallback, so it just shows you the good sense of parents. I certainly wouldn't have done it myself. I had no intention of becoming a civil servant, but
always have plan B.
That's plan B, kicked into plan A in rapid order, and I joined the civil service, and depending on the place you got the exams, they appoint you to different departments. So I was lucky. I got appointed to CNAG's office into the commercial audit sector, which is the semi-states associated with what was known in those days as the Department of Transport and Power and Industry and Commerce, now the Department of Enterprise, Trade and Employment.
And when you got to that position, presumably you still didn't know what the plan was, or was there a plan?
No, I think the plan at that stage was, I was the eldest. I got a scholarship to Galway University because I did Irish in school, but there was no point in going to Galway University. My parents hadn't got the money to actually put me up in Galway, whereas fees would have been paid. So anyway, the idea was to earn some money. I was the eldest in the family, and I don't think I was ever as wealthy again as I was in those days, because I had no outgoings and I had a decent salary. But I realised, and my mother more importantly decided, that I wasn't going to do nothing in terms of academia. So again, showing real foresight and a really good plan for my future career, I did a BA at Knighton when I was 20. You couldn't do it any earlier. And I did history and Irish, which is ideally suited for accountancy and auditing and so on. So once again, the lack of certainty as to where I was heading. And then got those. I got married before I finished my degree, and my wife made absolutely certain that I was finishing my degree because she wasn't going to have my mother on her case. And then I started accountancy, and I got no credits for history and Irish for some strange reason. And 5 years later, I was accountant, and then I did an MSc in management in IMI Trinity. So I was studying for about 8 years after we got married, five of which we had one child or two children. Who thought that weekends were to come to visit me in the bed when I was studying.
So when you hit the you move from civil service to the commercial world, which you moved to Ericsson, was that a plan and in terms of step one on a roadmap that you had, or was it still a little bit kind of you know?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I mean, one of the benefits of actually having been sent to the CNAG's office, and more particularly the commercial audit, was I got a view from the other side, and I've always believed that things always look different from the other side. But I saw business in action. I was lucky enough to cross a range of industries. Government bodies, but like I did the audit of NET, I did the audit of Bord na Mona, so then I did the audit of Central Bank and Bord Fáilte. So I got a lot of visibility. I got, ironically enough, given what happened laterally, I did the audit of Shannon Airport and Dublin Airport, and the IDA. After about 6 years, I mean, I was lucky. The civil service was a great place to be doing exams at night, and I don't mean that we weren't working hard, but it wasn't as driven as private enterprise, putting it bluntly, in those days. So I decided I wanted out, but getting out of the civil service, part qualified accountant, not fully qualified. I was lucky, and I had met a man called Donal O'Hare in Bord Fáilte, who had actually left Bord Fáilte, became the ran their headhunting consultancy, their executive search consultancy, and they were looking for a management accountant for Ericsson. And I rang him and said, what do you think? Actually, he said, put your name in. And John Ronahan, who was the CFO in Ericsson at the time, gave me an interview and took a bet on me. I'd be forever grateful to him, because I'm not sure I would have given me the job, but he did. And that's how I got out, because it was always difficult, A, being part qualified to get a full job. A job with Ericsson, which was and is an incredible company in this country. Like, Ericsson's are here, I think, since 1963, probably one of the longest standing multinationals. And really progressive, run by Vincent Daly and John Ronahan together, like two outstanding guys, who grew that company to be 1,200 or 1,300 people and still have a huge employment in one of the more progressive technologies. So I got into that literally on a wing and a prayer. Thanks to the instincts of a man who backed me.
Mm. And just developing that on further, you know, where there, you know, when you think back on the successes you had, who were the others that would have helped you and took a bet on you?
Well, I think in a way, without the people, I think I probably would have been in a very different place. I mean, John was one of the most critical. I mean, John encouraged me. I mean, I finished my exams. Between the Axis movement of John and my wife, I finished my exams. And he gave me access to a lot of his role. I mean, he was working on the principle that you keep getting people to achieve their full potential. And in his case, if it meant giving me more of his job, he did. And eventually he gave me his full job. And eventually he retired at the time he said he would. I never saw a man so very clear thinking. A genius, but the man who ran the company with John, the CEO and chair, Vincent Daly, became a huge mentor to me and was somebody if I was truthful, I'd say I tried to mimic almost. Now, he was an engineer and a very entrepreneurial thinker, even though he was in a multinational. But his approach to life, his commerciality, his ability to motivate people to do things that seemed impossible, but most importantly of all, his focus on, his laser-like focus on the prize. Mm. He had a great capacity to dismiss the irrelevant, even when it didn't seem irrelevant, until you looked at it in hindsight and realized, you know, that's what he was doing. So he was a huge influencer. Then I was lucky enough to be headhunted for Gilby's Group as CFO, and eventually became CEO in 91, 92. And again, people like David Dand, but it was outstanding. I mean, he was a visionary. But Ned Sullivan built Bailey's worldwide. I mean, I don't know any other person who has been such a successful marketeer as Ned. The production director was an outstanding guy from the middle of Ireland called the Three Jolly Pigeons, a guy called Tommy Murray. And Tommy was, he eventually did production work for Grand Met and Diageo in Greece. He turned the Greek plant around. He ended up in the States turning some of their manufacturing entities around. And he ended up actually doing a lot of mentoring work in, after he retired. Superb guy. And then the famous Tom Keaveney, anybody in the drinks industry associated with will know Tom Keaveney, who could sell sand to the Arabs, and certainly if you wanted to learn how to sell and how the market worked, Tom was excellent. So they were great influencers. And then finally, Bernie Cowell asked me to join Aer Lingus. And Bernie, if ever I think of people you want at your back if you're in a fight, Bernie Cowell was the man. Man had no fear. Absolutely incredible. He was an Islander. He always reminded me of that. He was from Bear Island. And he said, Islanders are built tough. And like Bernie had been through any number of skirmishes, had retired several times, but was still going strong when he sadly died, ironically, in a water accident for a man who'd sailed the Atlantic, I think, twice. And then the last man in my career is Michael Smurfit, probably the best, most entrepreneurial and best deal maker I ever came across.
To what extent has fear of failure been a driving force for you?
Oh, massively. I think I wouldn't like to attribute it to everybody, but I think certainly if you're from a part of the country that has very limited natural resources, and the west of Ireland has less natural resources certainly than the east or the south, and indeed Ireland Inc., I've always had the view that Ireland, its only natural resources are its people, and the people are at their best when they're educated and enterprising, as I think we generally are. So I think, given that my parents literally worked day and night to educate, there were four of us, and their only focus was to get us educated, and then we're on our own. And I just felt, as the eldest, number one, but number two, I just felt I owed them a duty to actually not let them down. I owed them a duty to actually be as good as I could possibly be, and I owed them a duty to try to kind of set the role model. I mean, you know, the classic, I'm sure it was the east of Ireland as well, but the west of Ireland was like, look at the example you're setting your brother and your sister. And that was the regular shout. And so I took it to heart. So definitely fear of failure was what caused me to work harder, push harder. But also I think it was the other side of that equation is I wanted to make something of myself. And so when you marry the two, you get a kind of a strong force.
Do you self-analyse yourself and your decisions?
I'd have made an awful lot less mistakes if I'd self-analysed in advance. I certainly look back at times and really feel sore about not being a bit smarter in how I took some decisions. But I'm quite instinctive. I make a lot of decisions dependent on who is asking me and whom I'm engaging with. Am I the best judge of people? Probably not the best, but I'm not bad. But I probably could do with a little bit more analytical. But you know what? You can analyse to death too. And I don't. Do I have regrets? I certainly have regrets. But are they deep-rooted regrets? No. I mean, I regret things that hurt other people and things I did. But in terms of us and our family and where things are at, I think we've got a fair shake of the.
And you know, the whole idea of dealing with personal setbacks through your career. How do you deal with personal setbacks through the career?
I've tended to, and this kind of, I suppose, to some extent speaks to why I'm still working. Some people say I've failed retirement. I need to keep active. And so when I get setbacks, I get more active. I find a different way to go. I don't stop and analyze and brood and either turn inwards or outwards. Equally, I've never enjoyed the idea of rehearsing the day's work, the week's work, the month's work, or the year's work with people. I think living it once is enough. I mean, you've either made it or you haven't. Now, I don't mean that I don't consult and engage with colleagues, but Myra, my wife, is the long-suffering, who in the early years used to resent the fact that I wouldn't talk about what went on at work. I got to a stage early on where I had confidential information. We were living in a small town. So she was never at risk of leaking something she shouldn't. But she was regularly pumped by people who would say, you must know, there's something going on, what's going on? And she would say, I feel like an idiot when they tell me what was going on. Well, I said, don't feel like an idiot. It wasn't theirs to tell. Mm-hmm. So I never did that. And so therefore, I didn't find myself repeating or rehearsing it again. And to be honest with you, I find it, other than a bit of stop and think about what did or didn't go right, I think there's very little to be gained by it. It's exhausting.
You raise another interesting point. I recently saw Bruce Springsteen in concert. It was the first time ever, right? So don't worry, I'm not going to ask you to sing, okay? So that's the good news.
That's lucky.
But he's 73. He played for 3 hours nonstop. It was absolutely amazing, right? And at 73, if I could stand for 3 hours, I'd be very, very happy. But do you think age is a limiting factor if you still have the desire to do what you're doing?
Absolutely not. Right. I really, really think, I mean, clearly there are definite practical issues, like, you know, the knee joints are a bit sore, the ankle joints are a bit sore, slower. But if you're mental age and biological age, I think fundamentally different issues. And I do think the concept of people falling into the trap of ageism is silly. But there's no question or doubt about it. There are things that are more suitable for young people versus old people. But in terms, if you want to do something and enjoy doing something, I think you can do it for a long time. You can't. Yeah, I used to do a lot of running. I don't do road running anymore because I've wrecked most of my joints. But I do alternative things to stay reasonably fit. I think staying fit and staying interested and staying engaged, I think, has to be the recipe for a much better outcome. And he keeps himself incredibly fit. He's in the gym. He's like, he doesn't let anything go. And you look at him. I mean, he's
ripped. He's ripped.
I'm not quite that myself.
What was the hardest part on the journey?
I think the piece, when I read a lot of media in Ireland about all sorts of things, but to pick a contentious one, about pay and rations for our top executives, etc., I sometimes really get frustrated at the lack of understanding of what's involved in being a senior person or an executive are running an Irish international company or multinational company, and the commitment and the extent to which they work. So I would leave Ireland most weeks, if not on a Sunday night, on the first flight on a Monday morning, and I wouldn't be back until, if I wasn't in the furthest part of South America or China, I would arrive back on a Friday night late or a Saturday morning. And so what do I regret? My kids, I didn't see them. And then in the early years I was studying, and latterly you'd get back and you wouldn't be ready for kind of the football games. Mm. But it was a choice. My wife was fantastic. She stayed at home. She raised the kids. They were very self-secured. But, you know, I mean, my eldest daughter took me to a task. I think she was about 12, and basically got home one Friday night and my wife said to me, you need to talk to your daughter, and she said, you never come. She and I are fantastic. We all have a relationship. But she said to me, you're never at anything in the school. You've never been at this, never been at that. And I said, well, I need to work and I need to travel. But I said, what would you like to do? And she said, I want to go to rugby games with you. And so for many, many years, and even now, we still go to rugby internationals together. So that was kind of so we had a contract.
Right.
But that was a kind of a needed contract because of the circumstances.
When you look back through your career, there must have been plenty of times where, you know, you were either you were looking at a role or going for a role, or even when, you know, when you were CEO and you were looking at businesses that you were going to buy and things like that, that you said to yourself, I really, really want this, I have to get it, and ultimately didn't get it, right? Mm. And then a couple of months or a year later, something happens and you go, oh my God, thank Christ, I didn't get that because of what happened as a result. Either to the negative to that company or another opportunity came up that you wouldn't have been able to take.
Yeah, I mean, on a business front, I'm always minded of Michael Smurfit's great, you know, adage, that is, some of the best deals we did are the ones we didn't do. And so from a business point of view, he taught me one great thing, and that was to be clinically objective about business opportunities. Michael never regretted. He never looked back. He moved on immediately. And we walked away at the 13th hour quite often. On a personal basis, I can remember, you know, the old principle nowadays in terms of women and men, in terms of their opportunities for roles, and that women have this tough kind of mind mentality that maybe they ticketed the 10 boxes that are required for the role and they won't apply for it. The guys tick two and apply for it and take their chances. I was kind of in the probably 1 to 2 category. But I do remember in the heyday of GPA applying for a treasury role. And when I think, I mean, I don't embarrass too often, but that one is embarrassing. Somebody got me the interview with John Tierney, who was the main man in the finance world at that time, very incredibly capable man and highly regarded. I would say how he gave me a full interview is beyond me, because I didn't know how to spell the letters, never mind understand what covenants, you know, what type of covenants you'd have in a day. He asked me the most basic questions. I hadn't a breeze. So naturally, I didn't get the job. Now, it's not that I take any satisfaction in the demise of GPA, because obviously the GPA, former GPAers have all done fantastically well. But I think I might have made an awful hash of it and destroyed everybody if I had sneaked in under that rope.
We switched tact. Actually, one thing I wanted to discuss just before we switched tact to the business and management side of things. The career you've had, right, in terms of all the businesses that you run and things like that, have you ever thought about going down the entrepreneurial route?
I gave it a very passing thought when I was about 26, 27, and in fact, I dipped my toe in the water and it didn't go well at all. In fact, at one stage, I was unemployed, which was a shocking experience for somebody with my makeup, because the idea of not, and Myra was just about to have her second child, so it's kind of writ large in her mind and mine. But what struck me very forcefully, and I met a man in the search world whom I've been friendly with ever since, a man called Barry Herriot, and he had this theory, and I agree, I think he's right. There are people who are entrepreneurial and there are people who are managers. There are people who are good for small business and there are people who are good for big businesses. And arguably, I probably am, I'm certainly not the entrepreneur. I mean, Michael used to joke me about, you know, entrepreneurs are born, you can hire help, as he looked me straight in the two eyes. But I think also there are people who don't enjoy, you know, doing every job in the smaller company jobs and like to be more specialist. I'm probably a bigger company. Well, certainly history would suggest I'm a bigger company type guy. That's not that I'm bigger. It's just that the mentality is that way. So, no, not really. I mean, I as a result, I have huge regard for entrepreneurs. The big difference between entrepreneurs and me is while I take risks, and I said earlier I'm instinctive, my risk starts with a very small R. Mm. These entrepreneurs are real risk takers, and we need them.
Mm. You have to be hardwired a certain way.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, it just doesn't come. You can't teach that. That's the one thing you can't teach, no. I don't think, anyway.
And I think also that the word failure doesn't exist in their lexicon. It's just they need to go a different route. It's a cul-de-sac rather than a failure. It's just rehearse and go down the next road. Mm-hmm. And do it different.
It's not a failure, it's just experience.
Yeah, I look at Dennis O'Brien, I just admire, like, he had several goals, and he's, like, if ever you need to see a man who is well up for risk, and I won't say he enjoys all the battles, but he enjoys the business world and he's fantastic at it, and he has no limits to his view of what he can and can't do. And that's what we need. I mean, Islanders, we've, like, our only existence depends on our instincts and our capabilities.
I said, switching tacks now in terms of the business and the management side of it. As a CEO of a company, how important do you think clarity of purpose is?
I think I'm a real believer that a business without a very clearly defined purpose is highly unlikely to be either successful at all or as successful as it could be. And the reason I say that is I think the sense of purpose and the following, what follows in terms of sense of identity, is what binds people together. And the bigger the company becomes and the more you want to grow, the more you need to depend on people, delegate to people, you need to trust people, you need to empower them. And if they don't have this a common sense of purpose, and indeed a sense of standards, which ultimately all add together to the culture of the business, which I always describe culture as the way we do things. But if you have a sense of purpose and a common understanding of the way we do things, you can really rest reasonably at night if you pick good people, and you won't get them all right, but generally speaking, if you do that. And unless people buy into the sense of purpose, some people call it passion. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably overstated, but certainly the belief in the purpose and enjoyment in achieving the purpose.
But there's also that idea, though, if you want somebody to act like the owner of a business, you've got to make them the owner of the business. Whether that's by share options or whether it's by, and it's not necessarily by financial ownership, it can be much more about responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, I think Michael Smurfit, in the original incarnation of Smurfit, took a view that he wanted people that were prepared to effectively run their own business. And so we gave people plants, we gave younger people small plants, older people bigger plants, but we gave them the whole lot. So they were the general manager of the plant. We had plants in all sorts of places in the world, and they were in charge of sales, marketing, production, finance, external relations, etc. And what we did well, I think, is we didn't have Mr. Big or Mrs. Big arriving into town to be Mr. Smurfit or Mrs. Smurfit. They were the local general manager. That was the person that was identified. That was the Smurfit person. They were recognized as Smurfit. They knew the world name, the global name, but the person they identified with it was the local person. So there was a sense of, I won't say ego, but a sense of engagement and responsibility. And we gave them great latitude to succeed and to fail, because without this latitude to fail, they were never going to succeed. And out of them grew fantastic people within the organization. But there are people who've trained in Smurfits, running small plants or bigger plants in Smurfits, running businesses all over the place, because it was a great learning curve.
Do you obsess about the small things?
I suppose everybody has their... I lived in the country in Athlone, out in Roscommon side, and there was a lady who lived up the road from us. She had a wonderful way with words, but she used to talk about people's idiocracies, and I suppose everybody has some idiocracy. I can't read a piece of paper or a piece of writing without correcting the spelling and the grammar, and I can't look at a set of numbers without adding them up to check that they add up. That apart, and which drives people probably crazy, I don't really kind of go too detailed. I used to, and to be fair, Vincent Daly fixed that. I used to try to lean on people. I used to try to work. I certainly suffered from the syndrome, if you want it done right, do it yourself, in the early days. I wanted to succeed. I wanted it done right. I wanted us to be successful. But I didn't realize, and I latterly certainly did, where I had one CEO came to me in a company not all that long ago to say he was leaving when I didn't want him to leave. And he said, the reason I'm leaving is, he said, I am the bottleneck for this company. I can't run this business any differently than I do, and I'm all over everything. And there's only 7 days in the week. So we're not going to grow, because I can't cope with growing anymore unless you get rid of me. Mm. And I remember thinking that was the most honest kind of... And I certainly, thanks to Vincent Daly and John Ronan, I got taught that very early on, that if you wanted to be promoted, you needed A, to have the people. You couldn't get promoted if you didn't have your successor, and B, you needed to let your successor succeed.
Although you might not obsess about the small things, you still, I suppose, have to have a kind of a complacency radar. You don't want to kind of, you know, that everything just washes over and it doesn't matter.
No, I think the certainly any of the business I have, the main, and particularly internationally, you need structures and fora in which to review the business and stay in touch with what's going on. Try to have them as little as possible, but as much as possible, in order to be, A, clear that there's accountability and it's regular. I think if you go back to secondary school, where we were just exams-based versus continuous assessment, I think business is about exams and continuous assessment. The exams, you know, in the PLC world, it's every year end, whether you like it or not. You're going to have to post a set of numbers. Mm-hmm. They like them or they don't like them, and shareholders gain or lose as a result. But the continuous assessment is during that year that the systems and the review processes and the agreement of budgets and then delivery on them and the manner in which they're delivered, the what and the how, they're the things that I think you have to have. I think lack of process or trusting people gives them so total freedom, and you check in whenever is a disaster for everybody.
I suppose it's that idea of seeing beyond your shareholders to the idea that the stakeholders that have to be managed as well as shareholders.
Correct, and that's what I mean by the what and the how. You could deliver short-term, and the world, you could tell me, but the world feels a lot more short-term than it has in a long, long time. But you could deliver short-term and do so with a lot of angst going on behind the scenes. But if you want to deliver long-term, you need people who are going to work with you to have a vision, work with the vision. And as I said, the what is posting the results. The how is how you've delivered it with people. And I remember one of my reviews in Ericsson being told we had a great year, and I earned full bonus to be given half it, because they told me the trail of destruction I'd left behind was not sustainable. Mm-hmm. And that was a great lesson as well.
Switching to culture, and you've obviously been involved in a lot of global companies, but I'm always of a mind to think that, or ask the question, you know, can a global company with multiple locations and multiple operations really have one corporate culture?
I'd say that question probably is unanswerable. Mm-hmm. But if you turn it around and say, should they aspire to one core culture, I think the answer is yes, but not be open to and facilitating what I would call subcultures, suitably adapted local culture. If you accept my thesis, which is a very simplistic one, but I think is one that everybody, that culture really is how we do things, not what we do, but how we do things. That application can be different in different languages and different ecosystems, in different geographies, etc. So I, if you go back to the earlier point you made about, you know, allowing people to succeed and growing people. If you have, as we had in Smurfit, as we have in Flutter. Mm-hmm. Flutter itself is a bit like Diageo or Smurfit Kappa headquarters. It's a kind of like a master franchisee, franchisor. And then the franchisees, you know, they have guardrails and they have objectives and they get support in terms of branding from, in some cases, the centre, but local. And then they're free to succeed with their brands in their markets and their people. But the culture really is down to the mindset of the people and the sense of identity of the people, not just with the local brand. If you think of Unilever, you think of, as I said, Diageo, they'll all, depending on who they are and which company, the Unilever people will all tell you they work for Unilever. They don't work for J's Fluid, or they don't work for Nappy San or whatever. In Flutter, people will tell you they work for FanDuel, they work for Sportsbet, they work for Paddy Power. But Flutter itself is the binding kind of guardrail, definer, culture, and also enabler, because we actually enable them with capital, we enable them with thinking power. The top guys basically have a vision, and they're constantly recruiting with people to deliver on that vision, and we acquire businesses.
So, you know, is it as simple as saying, you know, in terms of the corporate culture, just establishing the belief in what's right and what's wrong? You know, do the right thing, don't do the wrong thing. And then that can, that a message as simple as that can be localized, because kind of everybody knows, well, that's the core thing.
Yeah, I mean, sounds like sex education Aristotle in my time. yeah, it does come to that. But I think you need to define a bit more what's right and what's wrong, particularly with young people coming through. So I think, as I said, I'm more inclined to actually define what's outside the pale, what's not acceptable, and give a freedom to act within the pale. Mm-hmm. But for example, you know, we may have a definition of how much we're prepared to invest in a market to grow it, in terms of the returns we want, how quickly do we want to pay back. And some markets might have different paybacks than others, but they're both good investment propositions. Where it comes to people, I think we need to be much clearer that people, we have to basically give people clear purpose, clear targets and objectives, regular and relevant personal development programs and reviews and feedback. People think that the world hates feedback. In the modern world, the kids, they demand it and have a right to it. So that they're not constrained by virtue of some hidden inhibit that they're unaware of, that they could fix if they were aware of. So I think it's all about community. It all boils down eventually, no matter how you run a business internationally, how big it is, communications. And there's no better communication than in person. So that's why I traveled a lot. I think that's why a lot of multinational CEOs and chairs travel a lot, because the business is out in the markets, in the operations, all over the world. There's no point in lifting the phone or having a Zoom call with them. Of course there is. But if I Zoom somebody, as the thing from going and visit them, you don't need to be a genius to figure out which one has more value for them in terms of motivation, in terms of just bothering to go and visit them and see them and talk to them about their business and hear how they're doing, question, push or whatever.
We'd so much to talk to Gary about that we couldn't possibly fit it all into one episode. So please join us next time on Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly for part two. And remember to like, share and subscribe if you enjoyed what you heard. Thanks for listening.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.